Now, this is the second of three talks on healing, and obviously the three lectures go together. I was very struck in reading the end of 2 Peter recently to see that Peter warns his readers about their treatment of the scriptures, especially with regard to the writings of the man he calls our beloved brother Paul. And he says that some of the things that Paul writes are hard to understand. So if Peter felt that, we needn't be ashamed that we sometimes feel it. Which things, he says, that are hard to understand, the ignorant and unstable twist to their own destruction. And I've been very interested in those two descriptive words of the people who make trouble with the Bible. People within the church who lead others astray. They are, on the one hand, ignorant, on the other hand, unstable. Now, unstable, I think, is one that I'd known before and often thought about. I'm sure we have noticed that people who get bees in their bonnets and drive them beyond all reasonable balance with other scriptural truths are often people who are temperamentally unbalanced. And you can see that unbalance in other parts of life, not only in their Christian life. So that unstable people have to be watched when it comes to teaching and understanding the Bible. But I was especially interested in the word ignorant because it has seemed to me more and more in the last few months that we are living in an increasingly ignorant age in this country with regard to the Bible. And I don't mean simply in the pew, I mean in the pulpit as well. It was because of certain things that one or two curates in our last preacher's conference said about healing that I decided that I must deal with it on three of our Sunday nights in the long vacation. I was quite honestly amazed that people could be ministers of the gospel and be so ignorant. That they could come out with verses and speak dogmatically about their meaning on issues that have been well thrashed over for many years, which a great deal has been written, and seem to show no knowledge of what had been written. And it so shattered me, I think, that I felt that if that is so in the pulpit, it can also be in all of us, because our knowledge of the Bible is comparatively thin today. People don't, by and large, have a Bible class background or a strong Sunday school background. And it seems, indeed, sometimes that Sunday school is more like play school than really serious learning. So I want to deal with this matter of ignorance in healing, and I want to say to those of you who are Christian medics and Christian nurses in particular, that if you are in this field, it is your business to know what the Bible has to say about the body. It's not an optional extra. It's not something that is of interest to theologians and preachers. It is your responsibility and business to know what the Bible teaches, and especially what the New Testament has to say, so that you can give people the hope that they need, and sometimes the comfort and the warnings that they need, and the right hopes for what God has for them. Now, just in case it seems, when you're dealing with a controversial issue, it's always necessary, of course, to say a good many no's. It does not mean this and it does not mean that. I don't think that you can speak controversially without that. And the impression can sometimes be given that we came to a session tonight that was largely negative. So to get it straight at the beginning that I am not negative about this matter, I want to turn to one verse in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 13. I'm afraid I have some wrong vibes when I look at this verse, because the principal of my theological college used to love to translate his Greek New Testament to us in early morning chapel. And the trouble with his translations were they turned out always to be just the authorized version. And the students used to get hysterics over this. And there was one famous occasion when he came to this marvelous sentence here at the end of it, verse 13b, 1 Corinthians 6:13b, the body is not meant for immorality, but for the Lord, and the Lord for the body. And all the way through this, he was searching for different words in which to put it. But in the end, the authorized version came out. And whenever there is a gathering of old students of the college of my generation, they always ask me for some reason to mimic the principle expounding this verse from the Greek New Testament. However, this is not actually a place for humor. It's a place of a very serious and wonderful statement. I love that statement. The body is for the Lord, And the Lord is for the body. Obviously, he's not talking about healing here, but purity. But the same thing is true throughout the Bible. So the Lord is not interested simply, is interested in our bodies as well as our spirit. Not simply interested in our spiritual lives. Our bodies are for the Lord. The moment we're Christians, our bodies belong to him. Obviously, therefore, immorality is out, and many other things come in if our body belongs to the Lord. And the Lord is for the body. So I want to make that perfectly plain at the beginning, that I think the Lord is interested in the bodily health of his people. Now, last time, we looked at some of the passages that were taken in the preacher's conference, in particular Isaiah 53, verses 4 and 5, and the misunderstandings that have come from those scriptures. Next time, in September, when it's my turn again, on a Sunday night, I'll be looking at other key scriptures that I think have often been misused, and in particular, I'll be looking at a passage that many of you will know in James chapter 5, and other passages that are often used in this controversy to discover what they mean and how we should use them. But rather than looking at a large number of verses and passages as I did last time and I shall do next time, today I'm going to look at one basic New Testament theme, and in the end, one passage only. A theme of very great importance, which I've called as my title, Now and Then. And so if you have an odd scrap of paper or a short shirt cuff, or like Simon Manchester, you use the back of your hand, that's the title for tonight's talk, Now and Then. And you'll understand later on just what I mean by those two words. Now, the passage in question is the one in Romans 8. But before we turn to that, I want to get you used to the theme that is going to be our theme in Romans 8. I want to get you in focus. I want to get you used to the idea. I want to show you that this theme doesn't come once only, but is scattered over the whole of the New Testament, this theme of now and then. So I'm going to give two preliminary little practices. At the end of these two practices, you're going to be able to find them all yourself. And you will come to Romans 8 much more able to understand it. And the first practice comes from 1 Corinthians chapter 13. 1 Corinthians 13, a very famous chapter, of course, starting at verse 8. Now you'll see the now and the then actually in verse 12. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. But let's lead up to verse 12 by starting at verse 8. Paul is talking about this Christian maturity, this Christian love, and he comes on to the subject of some of the gifts of the Spirit, prophecy and tongues and knowledge in verse 8. And the Corinthians have seen the bestowal of those gifts on the church in Corinth as a mark of perfection. They feel that in the gift of those particular spiritual gifts, God has brought them to full salvation. Paul is in earnest to show them that perfection and fullness of salvation is not for now, it is for eternity, for the life of the world to come. And so he says in verse 10, when the perfect comes, that is fullness, totality, completeness, the imperfect will pass away. But notice, when the perfect comes. The perfect lies in the future. It is going to come, but it's not now. And when it comes, the imperfect will pass away. And amongst the imperfect things that will pass away before eternity comes are the gifts of prophecy and tongues and knowledge. And so, by definition, these gifts, rather than being marks of perfection, Paul says, are marks of imperfection. They're marks of the fact that we're on the way to eternity, which we've not yet arrived there. They're marks, if you like, of the interim period before Christ comes again. So Paul is telling the Corinthian Christians that they can't expect perfection, fullness, now. What can they expect? Well, he tells them what they can expect in verse 11. When I was a child, I spoke like a child, I thought like a child, I reasoned like a child. When I became a man, I gave up childish ways. What Paul is saying there is that the aim of the Christian life is manhood or maturity, being grown up. Paul never likes the word perfection because it is so open to misunderstanding. There is no sinless perfection and no final completeness in the Christian life now. But I may be full grown. Now, obviously, the difference between a child and a man full grown is a difference that you can recognize as you walk along the street. So you say of that man, he is full grown. He has fully developed muscles or whatever it may be. but you're not saying that that man who is leading his son along the road, though he is full grown, is perfect. Any medic could give him a medical investigation for 20 minutes and show that he wasn't perfect. In fact, the little boy might have a more perfect body, but he is not full grown. So the language that Paul uses for Christian discipleship is the language of growth to maturity and not of coming to perfection. So he says you haven't reached perfection because you've got those gifts. You could reach maturity, but alas, you Christians in Corinth don't seem to do so. And if you glance on the same page at chapter 14, verse 20, you'll remember that this is a theme throughout the letter. Brethren, don't be children in your thinking. Be babes in evil, but in thinking be mature. That's one of the key verses, I think, for all of us in life. We're to grow up and be mature in our thinking, but as regards evil, be a baby. Don't think that you've got to know all these things. You don't have to buy Forum on the bookstore in order to discover all the secrets of sex, in order to be able to counsel other people. You know, there's a temptation, isn't there, of the devil to feel that we need to know all these things that everybody else seems to know. Now, in these matters of evil and perversion, we don't need to know. We can be children. We can be innocent. That's an ideal for the Christian. Very worthwhile reminding ourselves of that. When it comes to spiritual truth, we need to be full grown. Now then, verse 12. He's got ready then to say what he wants to say. But now, he says, we. And he associates himself as an apostle with the Christians in Corinth, and all Christians. He says, we, that is the apostle as well as you, we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. And the mirrors of those days were not the beautiful mirrors of today. They were more like the back of a Nescafe coffee tin. If you had to do your, pull out your, whatever you girls do, pull out your eyelashes and stick them on again, in the bottom of a Nescafe tin, you would find it a long and hard business, wouldn't you? So he says, as regards knowledge, we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face, immediate knowledge. Now that's an extraordinary thing for an apostle to say, isn't it? Because the apostle is quite clear that what he teaches them is the truth. Again and again, his letters say, what I'm telling you comes from the risen Christ, and you've got to believe what I say and obey it. There's no doubt about his apostolic authority. But here, you see, he adds the balancing truth, that though what he tells them is true, it is not the full truth. Because he himself is an apostle, only knows what God has given him to teach. He doesn't know it all, and he can't tell them everything. And there are many mysteries that we don't understand and that the apostle didn't understand. So that if the apostle Paul were to visit us tonight, fascinating as it would be, you might go up to him and ask him a question, and he would have to say, I don't know. That is the apostle Paul in the flesh. But you see, he says, then, face to face. Now I know in part what he knows is true, but only in part. Then I shall understand fully, even as I've been fully understood. As God understands you, as God looks at Chris there and Richard, you see, as he looks at people down here, God knows you through and through. I don't. Sometimes I don't even know your name, I'm ashamed to say. God knows you right through and through, and he knows me through and through. He knows absolutely everything about it. And on the last day, we shall know like that. But do we know now like that? Of course we don't. Yesterday in the car coming back from Wales, John Chapman and I were listening to a tape by an American Pentecostal leader. And part of it we disliked and part of it we liked. The part we disliked was the part where he was telling us how he foresaw the future, that God had given him a gift of knowledge and prophecy, and this was going to happen and that was going to happen. And quite frankly, it was dreadful rubbish. Just so happened that the tape was given several years ago, so we knew that it hadn't come to pass. But then he said, it was a very moving talk, actually. He was rebuking many Pentecostal leaders for majoring on the sensational and not getting down to private Bible study and prayer. And he was saying they were often praising but not praying, and they were often talking about knowledge but not studying. And he said that he had spent the last year of his life getting back to Bible study and reading. And he said, my, I've discovered how much I don't know. Now that coming from a considerable Christian leader, I thought was a grand thing to hear. Because anybody who's tried to know as he ought to know, knows how little he knows. Isn't that right? Everybody who's a student knows that. It's a little knowledge that is a dangerous thing, isn't it? And this is what you see in the church today. People with a little knowledge get put up in front of the microphone, and they lead many young Christians astray. But the more you know, the more you'll be willing to say, I don't know. Unless it's clearly written in the scriptures. So So there's a difference between now and then. You see, now I know in part, then I shall understand. Now and then. Now another one. 1 John chapter 3. Quickly over, please. 1 John chapter 3. See what love the Father has given us, that we should be called children of God, and so we are. The reason why the world does not know us is that it did not know him. Beloved, we are God's children now. It does not yet appear what we shall be, but we know that when he appears, that is, when he comes, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. And everyone who thus hopes in him purifies himself as he is pure. Now he says two things there quite simply. One, we are God's children now. Thank God you can say that if you're a Christian. Now I can call myself a child of God. But the second thing he says quite plainly is we are not yet like him, like our father. Are we? We're not like him. We're members of the family, but we're very far from carrying the fullness of the family likeness. But we have a great hope that when Jesus comes and we see him face to face, we shall be transformed into his likeness. And because we've got that goal, we purify ourselves now. Two things. I am a child of God now, but I am not holy like God now. Then I will be, but not now. Well, so throughout this letter, he tells them what they've got to do to be Christians, and very high standards they are. And yet, if anybody says that they don't have any sin, look at verse 8 of chapter 1, on just over the page at the left-hand side. If we say we have no sin, 1 John 1:8, we deceive ourselves. If we say that. You see, there were some people who were saying it. They said, we've got beyond that. We've advanced so much now that we don't sin. And he says, you just deceive yourself. Right, now let's turn to Romans 8. So now I'm a child of God, but I'm not, of course, perfect. But one day I will be. I just happen to, I have a collection of tracts. I collect tracts. If you see any lovely 19th century tracts, you know, Tommy has told the truth. There's lovely little drawings of Tommy on that. They're all a penny. If you find any of those in a second-hand bookshop, buy them for me, please, unless the price is astronomical, because I collect them. And here's a little tract from the 19th century called The Secret of Victory Over Sin by F. B. Meyer, a great writer of those days. And he gives help to deal with sin. But alas, he was one of these people who seemed to think that you could get perfect. If notwithstanding all these helps, you should still be betrayed into a sin and overtaken by a fault, do not lose heart. Go at once to your compassionate Savior. And if you thus live free from the power of sin, you will find that the Master will begin to use you as never before. Now that's sheer illusion. If you should be betrayed into a sin and overtaken by a fault, my dear brother and sister, you and I are overtaken by sins and betrayed into a fault 20, 30, 40 times a day. And God using you does not depend upon the fact that you might be betrayed into a fault in this next week. If I found you not betrayed into a fault in the next week, I'd know you were living in heaven. It's sheer illusion. People think they ought to talk that kind of language. It isn't true to life. We say that we have no sin, we deceive ourselves, and the truth is not in us. Now then, Romans 8. In Romans 8, he's talking about justification, this theme that we had down at Wales with the businessmen and their wives. And the sign of being justified is the gift of the Spirit. And the chapter 8 of Romans is about the gift of the Spirit and how the Spirit gives us assurance that we're children of God. That's the great theme of the chapter. It's all about assurance. And in particular, it's all about assurance in the light of suffering and death. I'm going to take up just six or seven verses from verse 18 to 25, because he's introduced the theme of suffering in verse 17. He's pointed out in verse 17 that we are children, and then he says, nevertheless, though we're children, we suffer. And then comes a glorious statement, verse 18. I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that is to be revealed to us. Very important, that, isn't it? You see, we sometimes overwhelm. One of the nurses last week was telling me from Great Ormond Street of a little boy who's just come in there, a schoolboy, and he's got leukemia. And he's a Christian boy, but he's very angry with God. And understandably so. He says to his nurse, 5 weeks ago I was at school and everything was going all right, and now I'm here. I've got no future. What would you say if you were the nurse? I told you, you've got to know the Bible. You've got to be able to say something to him. May not have many weeks to live. Well, one of the things, he's quite an intelligent lad of 10 or 11. He can understand perfectly well. One of the things we need to show him is verse 18, isn't it? That the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing. Oh, we don't believe that, do we? We'd do anything to hang on for the pleasures of this world because we don't think that heaven's going to make up for that. Because we've been conned, haven't we, by the Marxists and many others to pay no attention to eternity and to heaven. Well, that's the theme that Paul is on. Now, I want you to follow very closely with me in this next section because it's not immediately easy to understand. But Paul spells out with extraordinary power the suffering of this world and creation. And he gives three illustrations, and it's the second that I'm concerned with. The first illustration is in verse 19, 20, 21, and 22. It's the illustration of the created order. That is the sum total of human nature, animate and inanimate. Not human beings, but the whole created order, the beautiful world around us, the animals and all that. And he says that this created order waits with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God. And the word is standing on tiptoes with neck craned out, waiting to see God's sons revealed. Waiting for the last day, in other words. Waiting for the day when the whole company of the redeemed will be manifested as God's family. And the whole created order, it's a wonderful concept, is not out of the plan of God. It's waiting for that day. It's dependent on that day. Verse 20. For the creation was subjected to futility, not of its own will, but by the will of him who subjected it in hope. And that, of course, is Genesis 3, when a curse was laid upon the created order, so that when I go and dig my garden or do my job, it is labor and toil and sweat. And so nature is red in tooth and claw. So there are earthquakes and things that we don't understand. Something has dislocated it. Something has gone wrong. And so although there are wonderful seascapes to see on your holiday, there are also storms in which people drown unexpectedly. So something has gone wrong, and it sets us some quite big intellectual problems as Christians, doesn't it? So there's an important passage that this whole created order is somehow waiting for the day of liberation. Because, verse 21, the creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay. It's always decaying. And will obtain the glorious liberty of the children of God. Yes, one day the whole creation is going to join in this great liberation with the children of God. And we know that the whole creation has been groaning in travail together until now. So the whole creation is sighing, waiting for the great day of liberation. I don't fully understand that, and you don't. And yet it's a fascinating window, isn't it, into God's purposes for this whole world of ours, or of his. The third illustration we're not going to deal with is in verse 26 onwards, where he deals with the Holy Spirit, who also sighs and groans. Verse 26, with sighs too deep for words. And the reason that he sighs and groans is that God has placed his Spirit within you to make you like Jesus Christ, to bring you one day to eternity. And why does the Spirit groan? Because he's been placed within you. See, why does the Spirit groan? Because he's been placed within you. Anyone? Nick? That's right, Rupert, because it's such hard work. Now, that's perhaps not quite putting it fairly, because the task of bringing you to the Father is a task indeed fit for God. And he sighs to the Heavenly Father, Father, there is so much to change in this person. The Father understands the Spirit sighs and groans. Together, if you like, Father and Spirit are working to bring you one day to that glorious end. That's the picture there. Again, we won't stop on it. Now let's look at the middle bit. And this is very important. Not only the creation and the Spirit within us, verse 23, not only the creation, but we ourselves, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, grown inwardly as we wait for adoption as sons, the redemption of our bodies. I want you to look at that verse and just read it to yourself quietly for a moment. I want you to remember where it comes, and before you go to bed tonight, I want you to read again. See if you've understood it. First of all, he says, we know. So it's something that Christians ought to know. We know that we ourselves who have the first fruits of the Spirit. That is, we who are indwelt with the Spirit. Now notice what he calls that. He says that a man who has the Spirit, the gift of the Spirit within him, the man or the woman, the boy or the girl, has the first fruits. The first fruits were usually the first part of the harvest that man gave to God. But here he uses the first fruits of something that God gives to man. And he says that the gift of the Spirit to you, when you became a Christian, when God gave you the Spirit, can't be a Christian without the gift of the Spirit. That was the first gift, the first installment, the first part of the glory that God is going to give you through eternity. Only the first part. It's the earnest, the guarantee, like an engagement ring, a promise of something better to come. So when we talk about a person being filled with the Spirit, we need to remember that that only means that they have the first fruits of what God is going to give us, a foretaste. And therefore the Christian life is primarily not great experiences, but great expectations. The vast amount of what Christ bought for us on the cross is still to be enjoyed in the life of the world to come. It's still a matter of hope. And he says that in verse 24. He says, in this hope we were saved. We were saved in hope with a tremendous expectancy. And hope in the Bible is always certain hope. Right, back to verse 23. We ourselves who have the first fruits of the Spirit groan inwardly. So, it's not all joy to have the gift of the Spirit. Chapter 8, which is full of joyful things, is also full of problems. The problem of suffering and death, which leads us to groan as we go on duty, knowing that we're going to face that little fellow in his bed, not knowing what to make of life. Upset with God, upset with his parents, upset with the nurses, upset with life. And we say, oh Lord, I don't want to go on duty tonight. What am I going to say to him? Yes, we groan. We wish that we didn't have these problems. What does he say? We groan in travail till now. Keep going to verse 23, then 9, 22 and 23. 23 again. We ourselves who have the first fruits of the Spirit groan inwardly as we, what's the word? Wait. Now who's got an access card? Anybody got an access? Well, the more fool you is falling for their advertisement, isn't it? What's it the advertisement told you? I mustn't say that in front of Richard because he belongs to the network. But the advertisement says it takes the waiting out of wanting, doesn't it? Which means that you can go straight into the shop and buy that canoe for your holiday, even if you can't afford it. It takes the waiting out of wanting. Now, there are many Christians going around today who want to take the waiting out of wanting. You see, they come to us, and they find that we don't know all the truth, so they want to tell us how we can know it all. They come to us, and they find that we're not perfect, so they tell us how we can be perfectly victorious over sin, which is poppycock. They come to us finding that we too suffer, and we know people who are suffering, and they say, we can take the waiting out of wanting. We can tell you glorious news that God wills the perfect health of everybody who believes in Jesus. You can have it now, part of God's full purpose. They ought to teach you that at St. Helens. Because they don't, we're telling you the good news. We can take the waiting out of wanting. But you see, verse 23 doesn't say that at all. It says, we wait for the adoption of sons. But wait a minute, I thought we already were adopted. Look back at verse 14. All who are led by the Spirit of God are sons of God. For you did not receive the spirit of slavery to fall back into fear. Verse 15, you received the spirit of sonship. I am a son of God. I am a child of God. What do you mean that I wait for adoption? Well, I am a child of God, but there's part of that that I've not yet received. And that I have to wait for. There are part of the promise in my adoption papers that is not yet fulfilled. What is it? It's in the last phrase of verse 23. It's the redemption of our bodies. Now the redemption means quite simply deliverance or liberation. And interestingly, some of these people, especially in America and in other parts of the world where there are a great many churches of the more extreme Pentecostal variety, maybe here too as well, but I don't know of them, call themselves those who offer deliverance ministries. And they claim to offer you deliverance from all pain and suffering. And they ought, of course, to offer at the same time liberation from death, but that's harder. Now, what is Paul saying? He is simply saying that now I am a child of God, I'm forgiven, I'm adopted into his family, I have the joy of calling him my father, and he tells me all the joys that that means. But I have not yet got the redemption of my body. Spiritually, I'm alive. Physically, I'm doomed to die. Because I'm still a sinner, and just as in a forest, great forest, one of the forestry estates, we saw some in Wales, you often see that the foresters have gone and marked a tree with a white cross. It's a sign that it's going to be once going to be lopped the next time they come round. So there's a mark on me that I'm going to be lopped. My body is going to go into the crematorium. We had some gruesome details from Simon this morning. You see, and you just look at that ash and you say, is that really the end of a Christian? Surely if I've been redeemed by Christ and my Savior has conquered death, I oughtn't to finish up in a little casket of ashes. Playing on those kind of things, you see, that leads people to say, no, we can deliver you from that. Now, of course it is true that Christ's redeeming power applies to spirit and body. There is no disagreement amongst real Christians on that. His purpose is to make us whole. But what I'm wanting to insist on from Paul is that while the redemption of the spirit is mine now, I cannot claim the redemption of the body now. And therefore, you see, I am in a sense mixed up and split. In my spirit, I'm forgiven and can have access to God. And I know that my spirit is never going to die. The moment my body dies, I shall go straight in spirit to be with Christ, which is far better. But I know that my body is not going immediately to go to the resurrection. I'm not going to immediately be resurrected. My body will go into the grave. And we'll have to wait for the day of resurrection. So you see, the very fact of the intermediate state just tells me that I shall be with Christ in spirit, but my body waits in the grave, but on the last day, body and spirit will be reunited in the resurrection body and the whole redeemed man. So the very fact of the intermediate state tells me that my redemption comes to me, part one, part two. I know, therefore, that my forgiveness will never leave me. Remember that? Just thank God in your heart as I say that. My forgiveness, by the grace of God, will never leave me. My family membership will never be taken away from me. Thank God for that. But my health may leave me. And because my health leaves me, my family membership doesn't leave me. Right, I'm now going to summarize this in five simple sentences. And if you found that a little difficult going, if it's fairly new to you, you'll find these five sentences much simpler, I think, in order to summarize where we're going. Here's the first sentence. We cannot have heaven now. Revelation chapter 21, verse 4. Please all flip over to that. Great encouragement for me to hear the leaves going over. I know you're with me and are still attentive. Well, on that great day, God will come to his people and he will, verse 4, wipe away every tear. Death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain. For the former things have passed away. That's very interesting, isn't it? All those things are called former things. They belong not to heaven, they belong to earth. But we are still amongst the former things. We experience all those former things. You're very fortunate if you haven't yet mourned in your family. You're very fortunate if you've never met any pain. These things belong to life as we know it. They're part of the former things that on that great day will be done away. We can't have heaven now. Now, there were some teachers in the early church who wanted to have heaven now, and you'll find them in 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 18, and that is on page 199. Page 199 in the New Testament version, part 2 Timothy 2:18. Their names are given in verse 17. The talk of these people eats its way like gangrene. It's very dangerous talk. Among them are Hymenaeus and Philetus. 2 Timothy 2:18. What did Hymenaeus and Philetus have to say? Well, it's summed up in verse 18 that they swerved from the truth by holding that the resurrection is past already and upsetting the faith of some. Past the resurrection, when we became Christians, we were not only raised to newness of life, but we were fully raised to a deathless life. And it's very interesting that the theme of 2 Timothy, as some of you Bible students will know, is the theme of suffering. And in 2 Timothy, in his last letter, Paul is very anxious to tell Timothy that suffering is the name of the game, and that as a Christian leader, he'll know suffering. And therefore, it's interesting, isn't it, that he mentions the teachers who are going around the church and saying, no, Paul got it wrong. You needn't suffer. There's no need. We're past the cross. We're past the resurrection. Well, fully what they taught, we don't know. But we can see the lines along which they went, and that was false. Secondly, first was we cannot have heaven now. Wish we could, but can't. We must not sentimentalize the fact of death. There's a great danger of Christians becoming sentimentalists. Many of our modern choruses and hymns are sentimental. That is, there is no strong truth in them. They're just full of feelings. There's a danger of our worship services being full of feelings, and what that means is that on a Monday morning, I hit the deck flat, don't I? I've had great uplift on Sunday, but it doesn't last through till coffee time on Monday morning, because it was largely sentimental. Now, amongst healing, or rather false healing teachers, there's a great deal of sentimentalizing the fact of death. Death is looked at as a companion, and so on. Now, death is still an enemy. It's true that the sting has been drawn. What chapter in the Bible tells me that, please? 1 Corinthians 15, thank you. The sting is drawn, but it is still an enemy. And we saw that in Psalm 90 this morning. And you were fortunate if you heard that sermon. If not, get the tape of it. There we were reminded that death, even for an enemy, even for a Christian, is still an enemy. Now, alas, I think most of the copies of Miraculous Healing have left the bookstore when it was recommended last time. Let me therefore just read what the writer, Dr. Frost, has said. It's an old book, but he deals here with some people who taught in his day as they're teaching today. What grieves me is that you have teachers in the church in this country who teach what people were teaching 80 years ago, and they don't read the books that have dealt with these issues. They prefer ignorance, it seems. Dr. William Erdman once asked Dr. Simpson. Dr. Simpson was a man who believed that Christ gave us perfect health. He once asked Dr. Simpson why, according to his teaching, a Christian had to die. And the doctor was honest enough to say, quote, "I do not know." When Dr. Simpson wrote his book on miraculous healing, he had recourse to this language as the best statement he could make about death. When the end comes, why need it be with painful and depressing sickness, as the rotten apple falls in June from disease, or with a worm at the root? Why may it not be rather as the ripe apple would drop in September, mature, mellow, and ready to fall without a struggle into the gardener's hand? Unquote. Now that actually is sentimentalism, and this is what Dr. Frost says in comment. As a matter of fact, though Dr. Simpson did not intend it to be so, this is spiritual camouflage. For the illustration used is the covering up of the ugly truth that death is an enemy, that he insidiously lays hold of saint and sinner alike, that he brings disease of some sort sooner or later upon all, and that finally he gives the fatal grip and the individual, no matter what his prayer and faith may be, dies. So the time comes universally when the theory of physical life in the spirit breaks down and fails. Dr. Simpson found it so, and his last sickness and final death were anything but like the dropping of an apple in September into the gardener's hand. The same is true of Dr. Gordon and Dr. Cullis. And he points out with gentleness, but with great firmness, that both those great teachers of miraculous healing and physical life by the Spirit both died comparatively early in life from serious illnesses, and that both, incidentally, lost their assurance of salvation in their last illness. So thankfully they came back towards the end. Why did they lose their assurance? Well, because they believed that a child of God should always be perfectly well. And therefore when they weren't perfectly well, they lost their assurance that they were children of God, although they were leading Christian statesmen in America. And only the prayers of Christian counselors brought them back to assurance before they died. We must not sentimentalize the fact of death. Death is still an ugly thing for the Christian. And a smile and a text is not enough. To treat Christians as though they have no problem in dying is to be superficial and sentimental. You will find, if you counsel, and some of you are bound to be called to this kind of work, you will find that Christians very often go through a shadow and a valley because they've not been prepared that this sort of thing is a time of trial. Third, we ought not to be credulous, and to be credulous means to be too ready to believe. John Chapman was telling me today of the secretary of one of the biggest missionary societies in Australia, reputable clergyman, who was enthusing to him the other day of some healings in Latin America where people with bad teeth had their teeth miraculously filled with silver by God, and there were marks of the cross in their fillings. Now, as John Chapman said to him, that's to be worse than the medieval church at its worst. That is sheer credulity and superstition. That does not honor God. If you say you believe that kind of thing, then the world says the people who go to church can believe anything. No wonder they're Christians. You bring great harm on the cause of true faith. The logo for St. Helens, you know, is an idiotic picture, as you probably know. St. Helen, the mother of Constantine, finding the true cross. And Victorian Christians made it into a seal, or perhaps earlier than that, for this church. Oh, what an idiotic story. They say that enough people in the medieval church found the true cross to build a large ship made out of timber. It's sheer credulity. Do you really believe that the mother of Constantine found the true cross? Well, you just read the story of the Middle Ages. The trouble is people don't read history today. They don't realize that God has brought the church often through these times of credulity. And when you have times of superstition, you don't have times of true faith. The superstition always drives out true faith and true Bible knowledge. Fourth, we should fear to destroy the victory of faith. We should fear to destroy it. John was telling us down at Aberystwyth the marvelous story of Mrs. Bruce Smith, young mother of three children who died last year in their congregation, very young. And he was telling us the wonderful story of the last few weeks of her life as she handed over her three small boys to God and her husband to God. And he said what a great triumph of faith it was and how the whole church was uplifted by it. And he said in passing, I was so thankful that no nutcase was able to get to her and to disturb her with false promises and to make her feel that she was second-rate Christian because her faith did not deliver her from death. You see, that triumph was a triumph of faith. And to say that it's a better faith if God should, and God indeed may choose to heal, but to say that that is a better faith is simply to destroy the victory of faith. Fifth and lastly, we cannot and would not here at St. Helens seek to limit God. In Henry Frost's book, he gives five stories known to him from his own family and others where people were wonderfully healed in answer to prayer to God, and he gives five stories of equally godly people who in answer to prayer were not healed. And I think that's a very helpful balance. He is not wanting to say in this book that he wants to limit God. He is simply telling us what is the norm. In one of my favorite books on John Sung, the great Chinese evangelist, John Sung always used to have a healing meeting at the end of his evangelistic crusades. And sometimes people in answer to prayer would be wonderfully healed, especially, it seems, people who were on the edge of animism and paganism, where it seemed as though these signs were necessary to prove to them that the God of Christ was more powerful than the gods of their ancestors. Dr. Sung was fully aware of the dangers of this work, of credulity and even of superstition. As far as he was concerned, these meetings were primarily an opportunity for evangelism. It was of the first importance that the soul be saved. But if God should see fit to heal the body too, then all the glory was given to him. And there were many who were either healed or considerably relieved of suffering, and then later in the chapter he says that there were many who were not. That seems to me to be a very balanced way of putting it. We should pray for the sick. We ought to pray for the sick more than we do. We ought to pray with faith for the sick. as James tells us, and we'll look at that in a month's time. But we, in not seeking to limit God, we should not presume upon God and tell him that he must do something that he has not promised to do. Now, I see those 5 minutes to hop past. We're going to sing again, but it just so happened that as I went to meet Frank Retief by the bank underground and was walking to the church, I told him what my theme was tonight, and he immediately told me of a story from his own church. What church is not without this issue of counseling people who are sick? Sir Frank, I want you to come back just for 1 moment and tell me what you told me in my study just an hour ago. You would very kindly? Thank you so much. I went to question you. Would you just tell me what you told me?
David is a young fellow of 21 who with his family's brother, his mother and father 2 years ago found Christ in our church. Last year he was told that he had a terminal illness, and the moment the news leaked out, he had every crank and healer south of the border knocking on his door. He had books posted to him, phone calls made to him. Everybody came to lay hands on him. He was invited to various healing meetings and so on. For a while was thrown into great confusion. The confusion cleared when we were able to counsel with him. Certainly we prayed for his healing as well, let me tell you, because we believe that God is a God of the supernatural and that he can heal.
With oil, didn't you?
Certainly we laid hands on him as leaders in the church, anointed him with oil, but have pointed out to him that his focus should not be on the healing as much as on the purposes of God for his life right now. And he and his family came into a new understanding, a new dimension of discipleship, and he understood that he had opportunities of witness that I would never have. He was able to reach people who would listen to him because he was dying. And they entered into a period of real victory and glory. And they affected hundreds of people. And before I left to come to Amsterdam, I met with him, prayed with him, counseled with him. He had absolute peace and was looking forward to the glory if God chose to take him. And would give God the glory if God chose to heal him. Well, he went to heaven last Monday, and they had the funeral on Tuesday, and our church was totally packed. Well, that's over 1,000 people who came because of the impact that his life had on people around him. He had the victory of faith, and he wasn't healed, but nevertheless he lived in victory.
Thank you. Well, let's have a moment of quiet. You may like to pray for somebody in need physically that you are ministering to. We did say we'd pray for those 3 boys from Bethnal Green down at Limpsfield, so desperately needing salvation. And there are others who are desperately needing peace in times of trouble or bereavement or suffering. So let's pray just quietly in our hearts. And if you've got some problem that you want to pray with somebody here, well then 2 or 3 of us can go in a corner and pray together with you.